Chapter 3. A Toolkit for Theoretic Thinking. Oh dear, another chunk of jargon up front. What distinguishes this theoretic thinking from the kinds of thinking I have been talking about so far? And what set of cognitive tools is operating in it? Everyone has some sense of what theoretic thinking means. The trouble with using the term in a chapter title is that I run the danger of making into jargon something that has had a perfectly happy life in people's minds, designating something perhaps not as specific as I want to use it for here. An example might help introduce what I mean by the term. My wife and I were driving one of our sons to soccer when he was about 14. We were coming up to a federal election, and many of the lawns and windows we passed had sprouted posters in bright red, blue, yellow, and green, encouraging us to vote for one or another candidate and party. In the election 4 years earlier, our children had been interested in how many signs were up for our candidate, who had the most signs and the biggest signs, which party was likely to win, and how anyone could vote for the villains who opposed our good guys. Putting his soccer boots on in the car, on this later occasion, our son asked whether we had to pay to have a sign on our lawn, and whether people with the really big signs had to pay more, or did the candidates pay us to put signs on our lawns. I told him that the candidates and their parties paid to have the signs made, or made themselves, and people put them on their lawns freely to show their support. But why would people vote for some party because of a sign on a lawn? He reasonably asked, adding, if the parties and candidates represented particular social values and priorities, wouldn't people vote based on their principles rather than be swayed by lawn signs? We discussed this for a while, and his questions spread to the ways in which lawn signs were a part of the process of democratic elections. My point is not just to show off what a clever bunch of kids we have, though, but rather to indicate an example of a shift in thinking and in the set of cognitive tools being brought into play. And my purpose isn't to try to explain why this change occurs, typically in the mid-teens among students who have continued to develop their literate cognitive tools, but rather to describe some of its features in a way that illustrates how teachers might engage the theoretic imagination in learning. So I'll begin, as in preceding chapters, with an advance organizer describing the new set of cognitive tools. I will assume that this chapter will be of most interest to senior high school and college teachers, though some of these tools will have begun embryonic development in many younger students and could be used in earlier years where teachers think appropriate. Trying to compact these ideas into a table has been a challenge, and as I look at some of the definitions, they seem a bit clotted, but they do give some idea about these cognitive tools, and I will elaborate and clarify them below, I hope. Cognitive tools. Here are some of the main cognitive tools students will possess in greater or lesser degree as they develop theoretic thinking. The sense of abstract reality is a tool that enables us to make sense of the world in terms of ideas. The developing mind begins to construct an abstract world of general concepts that represents reality in a new way. It permits understanding of the processes by which nature and society work, and of our increasing control over these processes. It takes shape as part of the development of disembedded, rational, logically structured forms of thinking. The sense of agency is a tool that enables us to recognize ourselves as related to the world via complex causal chains and networks. This enables us to become more realistic in understanding how we can play roles in the real world, and understand ourselves as products of historical and social processes. Grasp of general ideas and their anomalies is a tool that enables us to perceive and construct abstract ideas about nature, society, history, and human psychology, and then recognize their inadequacy and rebuild them into more complex ideas. The search for authority and truth is a tool that helps assess the worth of general ideas, testing their validity so that meaning can be derived from them. This takes on a particular shape and importance with the development of abstract theoretic thinking, which seeks an objective, certain, privileged view of reality. Among the historical products of this cognitive tool at work have been dictionaries, encyclopedias, and textbooks, repositories of secured knowledge. Meta-narrative understanding is a tool that orders facts or events into general ideas and allows us to form emotional associations with them. That is, we don't just organize facts into theories, we shape even our theories into more general meta-narratives that further shape our emotional commitments. Here again, the above cognitive tools come into focus when we take the engagement of students' imaginations as a central concern. If engaging students' imaginations is held steadily to the fore as a condition of successful teaching, then these are the sort of categories that represent the kinds of things to which we should attend. If we think of our task as not just teaching knowledge and skills, but as also engaging our students with the general ideas that underlie the knowledge and skills they are learning, we will be able to make our teaching more engaging to their imaginations, more meaningful to them, and more interesting for ourselves as well. Also, the tools discussed in preceding chapters, stories, binary opposites, metaphors, mental images, extremes and limits, associating with heroes, the sense of wonder, and the rest, do not go away when theoretic abstractions develop. They remain available to be used. The sense of abstract reality. My son's discussion of election lawn signs illustrates how the everyday reality of visible things begins to generate another reality made up of general ideas. What happened during this conversation and during other conversations and in subjects he was learning at school and seeing on TV was the generation of new meaning to the idea of politics into the idea of society, into the idea of democracy. In addition, these hugely abstract ideas were being connected one to another as well. In the past, no doubt, he understood, in the sense of being able to give some adequate definition of, the words politics, society, and democracy. But the conversation in the car indicated that these words were taking on new and quite significantly different meanings. No doubt he had used these words in conversations before, but they were now beginning to appear in discussions more frequently and prominently. They were no longer words he knew the meanings of. They had become, in some sense, things in their own right. Society was not now a rarely used and rather vague term. It used to refer vaguely to houses and families and neighborhoods and social services and the government and so on. Now it was gathering precise meaning as an abstract composite of all those things. Theoretic thinking is the development of this new world of abstract ideas, and the growing ability to think in terms of these abstractions, and then connect the results of abstract thinking back to the concrete world. We can see it, and feel something of the difficulty of this kind of thinking, in those familiar word puzzles in math that ask, for example, if a man took a train headed east from Albuquerque at 60 miles an hour, and another man took a train traveling at 80 miles an hour from, and invite the student to calculate where they would pass each other. What students would like to be able to do with such problems is stay in the real world and watch the actual trains, from about a mile up, and observe where they pass each other. But this is math class, and what the teacher wants the students to do is leave behind the world of the anonymous man on the train from Albuquerque, and abstract the problem from the real-world situation and convert it into numbers, and apply a formula, and calculate where the two men would pass. The problem includes no invitation to wonder whether they are sad or happy, or tall or short, or good at baseball, or fathers of sons who want to know why people would vote for a candidate because there are lots of lawn signs with their name on it. Instead, it presents an invitation to enter the realm of abstract reality. During the period when literacy drives the development of the cognitive tools discussed in Chapter 2, the student's engagement of reality is quite different from that which occurs with the development of abstract theoretic thinking. We might get some clearer sense of the difference by thinking of students' educational development as like exploring a landscape, or finding their way around that Italian hill town I generously, virtually, took you to in Chapter 2. Students use the tools they developed earlier to explore by trying to get a sense of the most extreme features of the environment, finding out its limits, looking in awe at the biggest buildings, locating the main square, and so on. But now, faced by the same task, they would set out drawing a map, an overview, an image of the relationships of all the pieces within the whole. That is, they will now always search for a general view. In the imaginative classroom, the language of the theoretical world will be commonly used, but the teacher will consistently support the students in understanding this language and using it themselves. The support can come by giving frequent examples of the particular elements from which the general words are derived. When, for example, the word society is used, the teacher will not assume that all students will have in place a robust theoretic sense of its meaning. So, on occasion, the teacher can elaborate a bit, reminding students how the term developed. I find that a dictionary of word origins can be invaluable for supporting the development of theoretic cognitive tools. So, in 5 minutes or less, the teacher can discover that the word comes from the Latin socius, which means a companion. Our society is made up of our companions, that is, people who share common purposes. Actually, companion means literally people who share bread with us, from come with and panis, bread. The word society began to be used more commonly in the 19th century, when society began to become more complex, and people increasingly felt they maybe didn't feel very companionable with many people in their shared society. The abstraction of the word suggests something of the difficulty people have now of being more precise about what everyone in a society shares in common. Well, what I intended to show here is not some accurate etymology, but rather the kind of talk that can draw students in the direction of theoretic thinking. Having begun talking about society like this, you can ask students for opinions about why the term became more common at the time when society became more complex and alienating for many. Then you might spend 5 minutes with the word alienating, but it might be useful to bear in mind that there is also a class to teach on some other topic. Everything we teach will have theoretic dimensions, and teachers will be able to stimulate and develop students' imaginations by being alert to the various theoretic paths that lead to and from whatever is being taught. If we are teaching about light and physics, it will be helpful to alert students to the main theoretical disputes that have taken place and continue to take place about the nature of light. And the same goes for Shakespeare, or the geography of ocean floors, or calculus, or anything. The trick for the teacher is being aware of the extent of theoretical thinking the particular group of students can handle by themselves, and be ready to provide support to those less sure-footed in this rather heady realm. The sense of agency. My son's lawn sign questions also hint at another shift that was going on in his thinking. 4 years earlier, at the preceding election, he was interested in sides and in what our chances were of beating the main opponents, and so on. None of his earlier questions suggested that this was some process in which he had any part, except as an observer or through his parents. But in the car, he is beginning to see that the lawn signs were just one part of a general process. His environment, that is, begins to shift from one of particular events and objects to one in which particular events and objects are parts of more general processes, which can only be understood by allowing words like society, politics, or democracy to become infused with new, important meaning. As my son begins to see the world as one in which abstractly described processes are both common and important for understanding, he also begins to develop a sense of himself as having a role to play in these processes. His very self, he begins to realize, is also a part of various processes. He is who he increasingly understands, as a result of things that happened in the past. He is part of a historical process. He comes to realize, I was born with a past. With the development of the cognitive tool that allows clearer understanding of abstract processes, comes the development of an understanding of oneself as having a role to play in those processes. As theoretic thinking becomes more elaborated, so too will students sense of themselves as agents in social, historical, political, and familial processes. In the imaginative classroom, we will seek to encourage the development of this cognitive tool by encouraging students to take part in activities that will help stimulate their sense of agency. Most subjects in the curriculum can go beyond simple mastery of the material to offer opportunities for students to look outward to society in general and recognize that they can play roles of value or pleasure. Service activities are one common way to support this developing cognitive tool. Students can help out at elections, interview old people they know or can be put in touch with, write letters to politicians on issues that have come up in their classes, or write letters to historical figures they have been learning about. Napoleon is as likely to read them as some politicians today. They can be encouraged to vote in online referenda on issues that interest them, and they can help out with some environmental preservation or reclamation project, involve themselves in church activities, or help a group of friends form a club or team of some kind. Math examples that focus on important local issues, bringing statistical clarity where there has been only rhetoric, can lead to a letter to the newspaper. Geography examples can lead to a reclamation project. Historical studies that enlighten a current political issue can be written up and sent to participants in the issue. I often think current proponents of voucher systems in education might benefit from a brief and clear account of the late 19th century payment-by-results schemes in England. Implications of physics or chemistry studies can be directed to outside groups for whom they have relevance. The purpose of these quick examples is not to engage students in some particular form of activism or to select for the curriculum things that are especially relevant to current social conditions, but to show how the regular curriculum yields endless examples of new learning that students can use to stimulate and develop their sense of agency within the processes that surround them. General ideas and their anomalies. Theoretic thinking is accompanied by, or caused by, the development of a perspective on the world that begins with the general, so that events and objects are seen in terms of the process, system, or whole of which they are parts. Perhaps the easiest example of this is the student's understanding of history. During the earlier period, they saw history as a series of dramatic events and characters, styles of dress and modes of shelter, and so on. The student's interest was caught by the heroic character, the courageous rebellion, the wise ruler, the astonishing achievement, the exotic customs. Now these are no longer seen as more or less isolated characters and incidents. They are understood in terms of the complex process of history, as examples of a continuum of styles and customs, of a range of possible human behaviors within physical, psychological, and emotional constraints. The meaning of historical events is now located in some general belief about the whole process, and the meaning of particular events is derived from that conception of the whole. The arrival of Columbus in North America is no longer seen simply as a heroic achievement full of good or evil consequences. It is seen rather as an element in large narratives of technological development, of national cohesiveness, and royal or bourgeois investments, of patterns of disease and immunity, of the spread of plant species around the planet, of the character of European culture as exemplified in its contacts and conflicts with Aboriginal Americans, and the character of American cultures as exemplified in their contact and conflicts with Europeans, and in dozens of large meta-narratives that can be used to prescribe the meaning of the contact. By seeing the event in light of multiple meta-narratives, students will learn the complexity of the truth of the event. And Columbus's role in multiple narratives will further the process of sophistication in theoretic thinking. Some students who develop theoretic thinking may conclude, for example, that the huge generalization that the world is going to hell in a handcart is true. They will accept much without qualification that stupid and greedy decisions are being made that will wreck our environment, run us out of fuel supplies, destroy our industries and cities, and so on. Alternatively, other students might conclude that the world is gradually getting better, that human beings do create crises for themselves, but their energy and ingenuity always solve the problems, and that life is on an uneven but gradually upward curve toward a better future for all. We may call such people pessimists and optimists, though they all call themselves realistic. But their pessimism and optimism have been made into theories of history and society. There is no use simply confronting either of these positions with the opposite, as each will think the others are simply ignoring the important information that supports the right set of beliefs and is instead focused on superficial and largely irrelevant facts. The route to developing theoretic thinking is in part a familiar old technique. We sometimes call it the dialectic, questioning and answering in defense of some hypothesis. Most commonly, for example, it might involve the optimist and the pessimist questioning and answering each other in an attempt to reach the truth. Of course, what such a method usually achieves is greater sophistication in methods of argument, not agreement with the truth. Students who are inclined to believe that everything is going to hell in a handcart, a phrase that sounds better than the image it generates, can be helped to make their belief more complicated by being shown specific cases of obvious improvement in people's lives. One might point to surgical techniques that enable older people with arthritic joints to get around with greater ease and less pain. The pessimistic student will have no difficulty accepting that some things, like this, may be getting better, but will maintain that on the whole, things are getting worse. The example serves as an anomaly to the general belief. It is not a counterargument. It is not part of an argument for an optimistic view of current conditions and their general direction. It is just an anomaly to the general belief. Nonetheless, the belief must be reformulated, in however small a way, to take account of the exceptions to the general view. One might then add other anomalies. One might point to the eradication of certain diseases. This might encourage the pessimistic student to modify the general belief a little more, or it might lead to the claim that eradicating diseases only makes overpopulation worse and will hasten the catastrophic effects of mass starvation. One might then add the anomaly to this position that more food per person is being produced now, and so on. The teacher might provide similar kinds of anomalies to the students who take the optimistic view. In positing anomalies to any belief or general position, the aim is not to disprove the belief, but simply to compel its holders to make their position more and more sophisticated. The fruit of this procedure is not truth with a capital T, but an eventual recognition by the students that such general truths are not realizable. There are good grounds to think some things are getting better and that some are getting worse, even if during this century we run out of breathable air and drinkable water, and perhaps blow up the planet. This won't prove the pessimists' current hypotheses true. It will mean that the grounds for their present predictions were well-founded, but that is different from the general belief that they are true. What this more complex and sophisticated condition achieves is a reduction of general and unsustainable ideological and metaphysical beliefs about human nature, society, and history. And this condition of mind should allow us to focus more clearly on current problems and hopes behind which we can throw our efforts. Why am I dragging you through this rather vague and general discussion? Well, I wanted to sketch a pedagogical method that is particularly useful for helping students develop theoretic thinking. Forming general ideas and then dealing with anomalies to those ideas is one of the main tools for furthering students' education once this process of building abstract worlds has begun. It's not the quantity of physics or history they learn that will make our students more educated. It is the degree of sophistication of the theoretic thinking they develop in the process of learning physics and history that is crucial, and the sophistication of the theoretic thinking they use to understand the physics and history. Indeed, and hardly coincidentally, to move through this process, the students will have to learn a great deal of physics and history and other subjects. The anomalies only work if they spur students on to discover new knowledge, to defend their increasingly precariously held theories and general schemes.